Gaming Regulatory Oversight Authority, entering into its X number, X meeting. And we're all weary, but seem to be in good spirits. So that's good. Okay. We've got a full agenda. I should say that Attorney Sullivan's going to be a bit late. She had client business to attend to. And Patrick Cheatham is, I don't think, going to be here today. He is away. He's away. He could not be here. I think that's it, isn't it?
General Foster. Yeah.
General Foster's not here. My goodness. But he, I'm sure, will be here. So I'd like to just get going anyway. We have a quorum. And at the outset, I wanted to say that we're going to begin walking through some of the core choices that we have to make. And we may begin making some of those choices in a preliminary way today. No choice becomes final until we're done with it. And this is how I expect we will hope that we can proceed. We will today have a presentation on the fiscal and capacity issues. You already have a report. It's being posted on the website as we speak, I think.
Yes.
And there are a few extra copies here. If anybody out there wishes to have that, I do have a few extra copies here, a few more. So maybe those should go out to the end of the table. And then after that, we will talk about the choices we might make about fiscal and capacity issues. And I have a handout that I'll hand around to help us think about how we might do that. And then we'll proceed on to the sort of structural questions, regulatory agency options. I also have a health chart, a set of schematics to help us walk through that. We'll move on to problem gambling. Representative Weber and I had a very interesting day down in Boston. We'll report on that. Again, identify options. We'll go back to the expanded gaming report that was prepared primarily, well, by White Sands, I guess I should say, and walk through some other core observations, recommendations in that report with the help of Attorney Williamson. And if we have time, we'll come back around to existing gaming issues. And then next week, we will make whatever choices remain to be made on a preliminary basis, so that following that time, real drafting work on a draft bill and draft report can begin, and then we'll consider that after Thanksgiving. And I think that the way we will proceed next week is what I would call on an exception basis, to make sure we get through everything. And what I mean by that is that we have Senate Bill 152 omnibus version. Our consultant has advised us that it's a good base. That's not to say we make all or even most of the choices the same way, or have the details the same way, but it's a good base. So you have that before you, and you have the consultant's recommendations. What I'd be meaning by an exception basis is that anything that does not come up directly as we walk through particular issues, I leave to you to bring up if they're problematic from your point of view, and then we can consider them and make a choice. That way, we don't have to all get bored of all the technical details. I want to say a lot is technical, a lot of the fixing is a technical fix, and unless I'm mistaken, again, that's for you to tell me, most of that can be left to the drafting work. So that's how I plan to proceed. Your concerns or thoughts about that, there's time to discuss, and then we'll move on into the presentation. So I think we're all set. Why don't we go ahead, Mr. Nicholson?
Good morning. Initially, I'd just like to say, go Sox. I wanted to go over the report that's just recently been distributed at a high level, just to walk through a bit of our methodology, maybe some of the results, and then if there's any questions, I'd be glad to address them. We have our own methodology when we do a feasibility study. We look at specific demographics and other attributes of the gaming jurisdiction that's being evaluated, things like population, income levels, age, nearby competition, and gaming tax rates. We look at that those items within rings of 30, 60, 90 miles, and I know I learned a lot. I had been to New Hampshire, familiar with New England. I have a brother that lives in Vermont, relatives in Massachusetts, but I did learn quite a bit, and the first thing that got me was within 30 miles of southern New Hampshire, 2.8 million people. We go to 60 miles, and it's over 7 million people. So, I mean, there is a strong demographic in the area. We then identify a competitive set. We look at other gaming properties with similar characteristics, similar demographics, just to use as a comparison and help get us to some decisions, some numbers. We look at the characteristics, gaming tax rates, all the same items and demographics of those competitors. I think in this case, Twin River in Rhode Island, Sands Bethlehem in northeastern Pennsylvania, and actually the Rivers Casino in Pittsburgh. And again, we understand all, each gaming jurisdiction is unique. There are factors, there's political factors, there's economic factors, regional factors that play in. So all these things need to be taken into consideration. And although, at the end of the day, although we vary to some degree on specific details, we have our opinions on certain things, there were no financially related aspects of the bill that are outside of what we have seen in the industry. So that was one of our conclusions. We think with what's going on in Massachusetts is a big factor in what's going on here. It's definitely not a silo, definitely not a vacuum. Those things are related. And if you look at the proposed landscape, something's going to happen in Springfield. Something's going to happen in Everett or East Boston. Something's going to happen maybe as close as Leominster. Leominster. And I tried that three different ways. but obviously, one of the factors is not only to leverage the local population, but to take advantage of the population and the economics of northern Massachusetts. I mean, that's definitely it. There are a lot of folks that even pretty close to Boston that will choose to come to southern New Hampshire rather than fight the traffic or drive 100 miles to Springfield or whatever. So there's a lot of advantages. We know now that people from Massachusetts like to come to New Hampshire for shopping. But given the tax rates and so on, you get a lot of people. You see a lot of Massachusetts tags in the malls. One of the things, again, being somewhat familiar, I was surprised by the liquor stores on the east side of the highway coming here, so they like to come and purchase those things as well, and lottery tickets and so on. So we know the consumers will come here, and again, that's an advantage to the area. And we did look at you have a decent-sized airport very close by. Obviously, Interstate 93, direct connect to the Boston area, and linking the states rather well. Route 3 is also a major artery that links the two states. And bottom line, the review is that the demographics of the region are favorable to the establishment of gaming in New Hampshire. I'll talk about the competitive section. The next big section, a section that takes up a big deal of the report, or the we're asked to a group of comparator states, a number of, I think maybe there were 9 states that we actually went into detail and looked at what the performances were there, what the tax rates, number of units. One of the factors people look at is the win per unit. That's a real barometer as to, you know, how gaming is performing in the jurisdiction, and that's win per unit per day. That's pretty much a universal industry standard on measurement of gaming performance. Getting into some other financial information, there's the application, licensing, and other fees. And the more I looked and compared and looked at the demographics and our team looked at these things, the licensing fee of you know, between $400,000 and $500,000 is a fair cost to the bidders. It's sufficient to cover, I think, obviously, there's a lot of that, you know, being used to cover the cost of background checks and related administrative fees related to the application process. It also serves to, I think, get rid of window shoppers or eliminate window shoppers and those less serious, and really limit it to quality operators that they're going to invest that much just to be considered for a license. Rates of taxation, and really, I mean, there's in the industry, and again, each jurisdiction is unique. Each state that legalizes gaming has different political, economic reasons for doing that. So there are different reasons for why states do different things. But obviously, as you move into this, Massachusetts is a major factor, and you've got to be competitive to some degree, I think, with local jurisdictions. You know, tax rates will affect long-term investment in facilities and affect overall economic impact of the related operation. One of the things, and again, we just see the goal of this process as a quality facility, not just, you know, gaming for the sake of gaming, but a resort type of development that is something to be proud of, and we're gaming is an amenity, but there's hotel, there's spa, there's, you know, other fine dining, retail, that is appealing and not, you know, not something to have problems with. So that one of the stipulations that we like is and good operators will do this anyway, but that they invest, let's say, 3 to 4% of their revenue back into the property on an annual basis. So that, you know, maintaining it starts out nice and it stays nice and maybe gets better over time. We think that you know, given the location and demographics, you will get top tier operators interested. And I think as we talk about the capital investment, I'll just jump to the capital investment. The bill talks about the capital investment, required capital, minimum capital investment, and we think that's good. Again, that will eliminate lower tier operators from getting involved. One of the things would be that investment may be spread out, and something to look at is allowing that investment to be over a period of time. You have the maximum of 5,000 slot machines and 150 table games, but I would be surprised. I don't see an operator coming in and doing those numbers, you know, within the first year. I in my mind, expect maybe 2,500-ish, you know, probably not more than 3,000 machines initially, maybe around 85 table games initially. But again, it's supply and demand. It's market-driven, and you might expect to see that increase depending on performance. I would expect to see, you know, a hotel there. So, you know, we do, and I think, given the caliber that we would of the operators, we would expect to, you know, want to be involved in New Hampshire, that you'll see investments and proposals much higher than what you're stating there. So, we think that's some fair numbers there. There were some other financial-related factors in there. The gaming floor analysis. There's no coin anymore. It's all ticket in, ticket out with the modern technology. And so there are a lot of unclaimed vouchers. There are what they call breakage or unclaimed winnings. A lot of times they're small denomination. Maybe somebody plays for a few hours and they have 35 cents on a ticket and they see a line at the machine. So they'll say, well, I'll do it next time, or it's not worth standing in line. But that adds up over time. There are unclaimed winnings. In the past, I think, years ago and traditionally, operators would take that as revenue, pay tax on it, just like anything else, and just think to get their percentage that way. Recently, in the last several years, states have really treated that as unclaimed assets, just like stocks, bonds, bank accounts that sit idle for a period of time. And the state said, well, no, that's ours. Either way, the money does add up. It's not tremendous numbers, but it's something to be considered. States have been taking that, and there's really, either way, it's not an issue, really. There's also pay table calculations, and I might even ask my associate Marty to maybe talk about that. But I think we just say keep pay table requirements out of the legislation itself and maybe addressed in regulatory rules which are developed, and really to provide flexibility and respond to market demand. We've seen that when states try and dictate minimums or maximums, they inadvertently sometimes eliminate new products and new technology, popular products from the marketplace, and sometimes will put a jurisdiction at competitive disadvantage. And is there anything you might want to add to that?
What you've seen in recent years, Nevada has a minimum theoretical payout percentage of 75%. Most tribes do that, follow that type of payout percentage. Then New Jersey has a minimum theoretical payout percentage of 83%. Then Pennsylvania went to 85%. Then Maryland went to an average of 87%. And what you saw is a movement that would suggest that each state is being more consumer protective and making sure that the payout percentages are higher. But due to the nature of the underlying mathematics on these games, you are limiting some of the very popular products that come in game design, in the sense that, and it's convoluted and I'm not the best spokesman for it, but basically your most popular games really are driven by time on device. It's not, one big hit over an hour. It's the entertainment value of little returns over periods of time. And the way the pays and plays are calculated and what they can do, a game developer can do with a bonus round or whatever, is impacted. So if you get up, proposed... the omnibus bill was as high as 90% on an average theoretical. And that means that when a New Hampshire operator would go to pick his games mix, there's an entire catalog of very popular games that are used in New Jersey and in Pennsylvania and in your surrounding states that would not be available to a New Hampshire operator. And so you're just limiting their dexterity. And due to the nature of the way floors are configured, you're not necessarily doing anything that's consumer protective. You're just impacting their ability to offer a product mix that's competitive with their neighbor. And so you want to just think about a good return. I think you want to think in terms of following the traditional view of having it be a minimum theoretical payout percentage rather than actual averages. Because when you purchase or lease a slot machine, you have, or via the video lottery terminal, you have what's called a par sheet. and that gives you how that game is configured and what the minimum theoretical is. So if you do your requirements in terms of a minimum theoretical, you're staying within sort of the standard approach. Now what's interesting, and it's I'm not saying it's the first time, but it's the first time I've seen it in a larger jurisdiction, the Massachusetts statute is conspicuous in the fact that it does not specify a payout percentage. And they intend to do that by rulemaking, which means that with rulemaking, they're going to maintain a flexibility going forward. You know, Maryland, with the average 87%, there were things that were in the Maryland statute that in actual implementation were a nightmare to do regs with. But once it's in the statute, it's hardwired. Whereas the Massachusetts is taking an approach that will allow them, through rulemaking, to have more dexterity there. So that's a kind of new approach or a newer approach to it, but something, you know, for the authority to think about in its recommendation.
And just one more thing on that is that these the percentages are calculated on literally thousands of pools, and it could be and a lot of times they're accruing to a jackpot percent. And if you measured a certain period of time, you'll find you maybe didn't hit those averages, let's say,
right,
because of the timing factor, and could eliminate.
And when you actually look at floor statistics, I mean, in other words, you don't think of the minimum payout percentage as being the bottom. In other words, the minimum theoretical is 83% in New Jersey. But if you were to look at the statistics of the majority of games that are on the floor in New Jersey, they are set 95% and above. I mean, they're, you know, but it's just a matter of the game math and whether or not you can do that percentage in the context of different bonus rounds and things of that nature. I can certainly, this is a topic that I find very difficult to discuss because it's so much math. It's a, you know, I can certainly provide the board with the authority with a better description, but suffice it to say that at a certain point, you're unnecessarily hamstringing an operator that would come in here and you're not doing, you know, anything that is terribly consumer protective. I think, for example, Pennsylvania is using an 85% minimum theoretical. I think that's a nice middle-of-the-road position. They're able to do very well with that, stay very competitive with that, and it's still higher than the majority of jurisdictions.
Why don't you continue your presentation?
There's a piece in there about other obligations for operators regarding employment, workforce development, you know, affirmative standards. And you will find, I mean, just from experience, that operators, I guess initially, will make every effort possible to be good citizens. We find them to be active in local charities, in local schools, and education. They like to have an educated workforce, just like many businesses. And they will include, as you move forward, and at some point, if it gets to that point where you're accepting applications, they will make a big deal of their hiring goals. That will be part of their appeal to the authority, or to the decision makers. They'll include the employment numbers, they'll include, and they will set up training schools, they'll set up dealer schools. They'll have job fairs, and really will make every effort to educate and train the workforce as much as possible. Again, in a competitive environment, it's in their best interest to have a high level of customer service and skilled and talented workforce. Again, in most cases, they will only bring in, you know, from out of the jurisdiction, just a handful of top executives, and the rest of the workforce will come from the community. So putting stipulations and things in there is, you know, not a problem per se, because I think they'll meet and exceed whatever requirements may be in there. So that's some thoughts on that. The scope of our review also had a section on just a debate between a state-operated gaming facility versus private management, and Our attitude is just let professionals do what they do best. Private operators will be more motivated to generate higher revenues, which benefit employment, the workforce, the local community, the tax, the state as far as taxes. But obviously, there's a role for government in the oversight, the regulation, and auditing and so forth. We would try and say, we have not seen that work. I know Maryland, just as a somewhat recent example, tried to get too involved in it, and actually the state in the legislation, the state owned all of the slot machines. And then they realized, we need $250 million. And they had no budget for that, so they had to go and get a loan from another department, another agency. And they got out of that model as quickly as possible, because it just slowed down any, an operator will generate a floor mix, and then sometimes 20% of the year they'll change that. Well, this just put a bureaucracy on the ability to make changes based on market demand and so on, that it would advise against government ownership, but definitely review and oversight is definitely necessary and expected. And while I'm thinking about it, I think what operators, they just want to know what the rules are. What does the jurisdiction look like? What am I going to have to do? And they'll make a decision, that looks like, that's a New Jersey model, that's a this model, that's a combination of these. They just want to know what the playing field looks like so they can make their best offer and their best proposal to operate gaming in the jurisdiction. So that's really what they want to see out of it. It also mentions in there the use of auctions to determine licensing taxes. Well, this will become more or less some type of auction, because you will attract top-tier applicants. And at that point, it becomes a bidding process. You're going to look at what benefits the state of New Hampshire the most, and what's going to, whether it's hiring the most people or putting up the nicest facility, and the investment levels will be competitive. And in that way, it becomes somewhat of an auction environment anyway. So we think the minimums that you're putting out there, again, will attract the right level of participant. And I think what you're looking for. It will become a competitive process, and it will, I think, reduce, hopefully eliminate accusations of any type of favoritism. We'll have a sense of fairness there. One of the final financial things we did was just take sort of what was in the bill, and then what we think are really a range of options within some of the requirements that you put into the bill, and just did a couple of what we think are conservative assumptions to come up with some potential revenues and potential tax revenues for the state. Again, just what we think is a conservative model there, just to put out some idea of what it might look like. A couple other miscellaneous items, not necessarily financial, that were in there, was the discussion of a central computer system, and this is something that is really a relatively recent phenomenon. What you'll do is you're going to have, depending on who ultimately gets a license, if there is one, we'll have a casino management system which regulates and reports on and tracks slot machine activity, table game activity, the cage, the bank, so any transaction within those walls will be captured and documented and stored. These are very intricate systems, a lot of technology. People don't realize the level of technology in a gaming facility. But you will have these systems certified. You're not going to say, just bring in some system that we don't know anything about. They will go to an accredited lab, or again, with the proposed one facility, it's not worth having a lab yourself and spent making that type of investment when there are accredited labs accepted in literally 300 to 400 gaming jurisdictions around the world. So these are certified laboratories that will test these systems for you, give you a bill of health, and report to you on that. So you'll have this system, which your regulators will have access to. What we've seen some states do over the last several years is actually have a state central system, which is basically a redundant system actually monitoring and reporting, recording and reporting and storing the same, basically the same data. And anyone that is familiar with technology will notice that once you have two databases, they will never be in sync for a number of reasons. And the state says, well, this gives us security. We know what's going on. This is the official system. But there will be discrepancies, and you'll have accountants and auditors going back with debits and credits for a number of reasons, all legitimate. And just the reconciliation process is to have two systems for one facility, which will never be in sync. It's just there would have to be a compelling reason, we think, to have that.
A lot of times the central system is the language that you always see with the central system, and it's in the omnibus bill, is that if there's a connection to the central system in order to activate and disable video lottery terminals or slot machines. And there is a perception that, you know, there's a giant switch which can be thrown, and that's an additional level of control that a jurisdiction has. When in fact, and this is not to disparage a central system, I mean, it does the job. I think the question is for New Hampshire, is if you're looking at a smaller footprint and you're looking at a limited number of games, is this an expense that the state needs to incur? And because the fact is that although there's technically the ability to throw that switch, in fact, the games are connected in rows or sections, so the lines are installed so that, you know, it would be actually sequencing in 20 different sequences to close the games down. And, you know, it's not an event that occurs. And so it's kind of a sales pitch or a security pitch that's not going to be exercised. Sometimes there's a thought that in the event of an emergency, there should be, the massive closure of the games in order to assist with people getting out of the facility, for example. But if you have proper security department and they're equipped and staffed to do that, I guess the point is that there are alternative internal controls which work just as well. So states like Nevada and New Jersey have done very well with no central system, and they use alternative internal controls, and their regulators have direct access to the data systems, the casino management and slot data systems of their operators, and they have equal, or actually they have data that exceeds. Now, in your case, if you went with a central system, your regulators are going to have their central system, and they're going to have the full access to the data of the operators. It's just a matter of the balancing of the expense. But it's just it's a policy decision. It's something that needs to be decided. I just from a practical perspective, just want you to understand that there are alternative internal controls that work just as well. So just because it's sort of the latest rage where you're doing a big footprint like Pennsylvania that was going to do 14 properties, or Maryland that was going to do, 17,000 slot machines, if you're only thinking in terms of, one, two properties, 5,000 games, it may not be an expense that the state needs to incur. You may want to just look at the alternative internal controls, which, have been used for 30 or 40 years. You're fairly safe with those.
Can I touch with the numbers that you have there? Did you want to go over that?
Over the numbers themselves?
I think so.
Okay. Just one more idea, and then we can talk about some of the numbers. There was one more item in there about host community and rules for host community and impacted communities and their acceptance of casino development. And again, a bit of a philosophical area, a bit of where you can see maybe two extremes. Massachusetts, what just as recently, I actually don't know now, as we speak in Massachusetts, the communities actually vote as to whether they want this in their community. And that's something that's, again, to one end of the spectrum of the community acceptance. In Pennsylvania, the state assumed all control and actually over had priority over even local zoning commissions within cities. I mean, Philadelphia had no say on where these would go. The state could dictate where they went. And that was basically another extreme. But there is impact, there will be impact to a community. And mostly you think of traffic, you know, being an issue, you know, on a Friday night, Saturday night, the concerts or whatever going on there. So there will be some impact. There will be some level, again, when we had the former Pennsylvania board member here, he talked about Penn State, which has a small community during the week. When there's football, there's 150,000 additional people there. So, yes, there is an uptick in crime or incidents or whatever you want to call it. So those things would impact, you know, a community. So there will be some, and as part of the plans, as part of the application or the proposals that you get, they will specify this, you know, the community should have some involvement in what those impacts might be. And there will be remediation built into those proposals. So these are things that again, there's two extremes, but the operators will be willing and understand that there's some level. We saw some potential properties before they even, I guess they thought they had a good percentage of winning. Actually did a lot of roadway improvements and did jump handles and things like that off of highways in anticipation of people, you know, getting a license. So there's some thoughts on that. As far as we did put towards the end of the report itself, I had mentioned before some projected revenues, and again we used what I thought was a conservative on the slot machines, $280 win per unit per day. I wouldn't be surprised if that was exceeded, you know, initially. And again, with the product being maintained, that might increase. We sort of use a growth rate of about 3% a year over a 10-year period. But you know, total tax revenue, and you know, close to the $100 million tax revenue range to the state. But again, growing over a period of time. As far as table game revenue, if I remember right, we used about a $2,400 win per unit per day. We see table games being popular in this jurisdiction, slot machines being popular as well. And anyone who gets close to $300 win per unit per day, that's a very good number there. So, and again, we project about a $280 win per unit based on that. And again, some of the other numbers that we used in our calculations were an initial $2,500 slot machine venue initially. I think that's a number that someone will probably come in and start off with in year one. And I think we used 85 table games. And again, that would be an initial, and we could see that increasing over a period of time. But I really don't see, you know, a facility with 5,000 slots and 150 table games, you know, in the market, you know, in the next few, you know, several years anyway. But again, those are good maximum numbers we can put for the jurisdiction.
All right, we have some questions that yes. People have been waiting patiently. Yeah. I know the first one I saw was over here.
Okay, thank you. Morning, thank you.
Yes.
Running back to theoretical payout, so if I could run for you, the question would be, the nightmare would look like the floor manager at the end of the quarter has to meet a theoretical payout of 90%, has a great paying machine that pays out over that, has to turn them off, remove them, to have the worst performing machines sit there at a lower payout to make the mix correct. Is that what that looks like in nightmare scenario?
The volatility period.
Yeah.
And the thing is, in your technical standards, you would have a reasonable slot volatility is the period of time
sure.
It will take to achieve
of course.
That.
Right. Yeah.
And so, you know, you're exactly right that it's because you're talking about these annual averages, you're creating, it's a false measure
sure.
of the performance of the game, and it's a false measure of the payback to the customer.
So somebody in compliance is looking, saying, we're at 91%.
Right.
Remove the ones at 90% or higher. Throw on some ones at 82, just so we can make our number, despite the competitive player going, I know this isn't winning as much, I'm leaving.
Right. And the thing is, a lot of times you'll have very popular games, like legacy games, that where the established protocol is that the you know, there are multiple bonus rounds, and that's why people enjoy them, that's why they play them, and it just would take some of those games and make them not available. I mean, games like Double Diamonds and, you know, what I would refer to as the legacy games, games that have been around for a lot of years, would arguably, you know, be anything up around the 90% average that's in the omnibus bill would really close the door on a lot of very popular themes and games.
Now, generally, I think what we see is a jurisdiction giving, approving a range of payouts, and operators actually do can change percentages, whole percentages on games, not as often as you think they do, but they definitely will do that. Usually, it's something that's requested in writing and then approved, and so on. So they have that range, and so they wouldn't necessarily maybe turn them off, but definitely adjust them to a different level, really, to get to your point. Yeah.
I have more questions. I think others can go.
That was helpful. Thank you.
Yeah.
Dan Foster. On local authorization, sometimes, depending on where a facility might be located, and you say hypothetically Hudson was one of the ones that was talked about, and the impact actually on Hudson is significant, but the impact on, for example, Nashua might be even more significant. That's the abutting city. That's where likely many employees would live. We fund our schools largely locally, so the impact on local school districts and so forth. Do you ever see local authorization being broader than just the community where it's sitting? I know that in Boston, arguably, when it's East Boston, all of Boston. I didn't even know that East Boston was a separate city. Maybe it is. Is there
a model for that?
I believe Massachusetts, if I'm correct, is using a two-tiered system where they have one set of criteria for the host community and then another set of criteria for a pending.
They call it local, I think, or affected or local.
I mean, could certainly, if the geography looks like that, you could certainly have two layers. The other thing I think that we need to be certain about is that the host community criteria is actually tied to impact. Because one of the things that happened in Pennsylvania, and they did not have a vote or referendum per se, but there was a big hearing process, a public input process, and it was very competitive. And you know, the Rivers in Pittsburgh was asked to build a new stadium for the Penguins, and that was a huge part of the negotiations. Has remained very controversial because last time I checked, the Penguins did not have a new stadium because that.
Payments were being made, at least for the most part.
The point is that a new stadium for the Penguins is not necessarily impact. You know, impact is traffic, impact is schools, impact is what's the police, fire, EMTs, all those things. And so if you don't, put some walls around it or some criteria around it, there are times when it's been pushed to limits. Now, you would talk to the city of Pittsburgh, maybe the stadium was very important to them, but it's not typically what a gaming company does.
It looks like the omnibus bill had 3% going to the host community and 1% to the abiding community. What you're saying is that you may want to look at impact when you're thinking about even dollars, I suppose, going out. Where's the impact actually being?
Right.
Senator Rush, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you. Maybe I'm missing it, but when your chart on your projections,
yes.
I understand your assumptions. The thing that I can't find, and I don't know what you have a triple X asterisk under discounted at 5%. I don't know what you're discounting. I haven't been able to. Is it the total tax revenue or I don't know what that 5% is.
Well, to be conservative, and that's actually they're actually in our. We have a model that does all the calculations, especially with a lot of algorithms. And actually, to be conservative, we actually, whatever we kind of thought, we actually just ratcheted back by 5%.
So it is off of your total tax revenue. You have discounted that by 5%.
Well, yes. Yeah, well, pretty much, yes, across the board. We said, okay, this is where we really think it should be, but let's, you know, just take 5% off. We'd rather... our philosophy is we would rather be conservative, and actually when you get results, you say, wow, we did better than you said, as opposed to pie in the sky, we think everything's fantastic, you're going to make $400 whimpering here every day. We just take what we sort of came up with and said, we just took it down 5% across the board.
Okay, so my triple asterisk goes under total tax revenue.
Yes, you could, yes, it would apply to that, yes.
Thank you.
One of the things we were asked to produce a fiscal note in response to 152 when the bill submitted for revenue projections. One of the things we looked at was certainly abutting jurisdictions' current gambling, and we found that Northern Middlesex and Northern Essex is the most prolific gambling jurisdictions in nearly the U.S. But Northern Middlesex, Northern Essex, just on lottery tickets, spend a per capita on $734 per person a year, which is almost four times the average in New Hampshire. Would that have an impact on revenues in your estimation?
Maybe to some degree. I don't think there's necessarily, just because I buy lottery tickets, I play slot machines, so it's not a direct correlation there. In fact, we've seen states that have implemented gaming, I think Pennsylvania, if I remember correctly, that lottery sales still continue to increase.
Yeah.
So just because, and again, Pennsylvania, we're no slouches. They over a couple of years, you know, there's 12, just up in there, I think there's 12. Yeah, 12, yeah. So that was a significant amount of options to gamble, but lottery tickets still increase.
I mean, certainly that's our experience. We've noticed the 10% drop in revenues in the abutting towns to Oxford, Maine. For no other reason, no other variable, at a time when, oddly, there are more people in the Conway region, tourism-wise, like meals and rooms tax is up, and our lottery sales is against the rest of the state, is an outlier at, you know, 10% loss, particularly on scratch tickets. It's where we noticed the drop. And our brother in Maine around Oxford noticed the same thing.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. And I think that's something I have not really seen a study of every jurisdiction with a lottery. I do know Nevada will not allow a lottery to gamble in Nevada.
No.
But I know there's two or three states, Pennsylvania being one. New Jersey, I think, continues to increase. But we've seen some impact.
Sure.
Maybe they didn't increase maybe as much as it could have. But there are people that have a gaming budget, and if it was lotteries, maybe it is split between. So, you know, I could understand some impact there.
Mm-hmm. Good. Any other questions? Okay, well, let's think for a moment about how we... what we do with this good information that we've gotten overseas. Thank you for providing that. We have to submit a report and a proposed piece of legislation. We had this discussion, I think, in our first meeting, what we would do about these fiscal questions, capacity questions, where there's a considerable amount of policy involved in the choice. It's not dictated by best practices. At some point, it becomes dictated by best practice considerations. When you get into a certain mode, you assume a single big casino in a certain part of the state. At that point, maybe
maybe there's some dictation, but it's still a lot of choice. So is that something we can do or not? I tend to think that it is not something that we can put into legislation, but it is very much something that we can speak to in our report. Here are the parameters. This is what we've learned about taxation, about capacity, about placement, and so forth, and about fees, about what should be done about the paying for the costs of regulation. That can all be in our report and a guide to legislative decision making. If we go down that road, we would have in our bill, when it came to when we come to taxation, for example, or let's say when we come to a number of gaming locations, gaming licenses, gaming positions, instead of having a specification of it shall be one location or two locations and there shall be no more than 5,000 gaming positions and so forth, we would put into our bill that there shall be such number of gaming locations, gaming licenses, and gaming positions as is determined by the general court. That would be the starter, that would be the, and we would work in the same way through the other items that sort of fall into this broad category, leaving to the legislative process the determination of the specifics. So if we did that, our bill would come out that way, and it would certainly be subject to amendment on the floor or in committee. That I want to put out for discussion. Yes.
I'm sorry, I want a question for you folks again. Is there a minimum number of machines and table positions required in order to have a Tier 1 facility?
I think a minimum is a good idea.
Only because at what point, leaving out open question, you folks are experts, I'd rather get the question on the floor now when you're here.
Yeah, my opinion would be, a minimum, I think, is a good idea, because you want a nice a property to be proud of, nice amenities, again, a variety of dining choices, retail, a hotel. So you want a certain level, and that's how we see it. The other option would be, a little more Wild West, where leave it open and you end up with 10 warehouses with slot machines, and it's a low-level experience, and if it's just about tax money, as opposed to that we want an upscale property. So having a minimum, again, will dictate what that investment will look like.
You were thinking 2,500 video lottery terminals and 85 table games is an attractive facility. Right. Something like BethWorks in Pennsylvania, that's...
They actually grew to that over a period of time.
And those are our first-tier properties, attractive, full-service entertainment properties. I think our concern was, could one property accommodate 5,000 VLTs and 150 slot machines? That, 150 table games, that would not... Probably one very nice facility probably would not go to that number of player positions.
And definitely not within the first years or several years. Yeah,
I really hear what you're saying, because I think if you don't put a floor on it, then you could end up with
a subpar
10 slots in a box, which you really don't want.
Send it around.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is White Sands has presented us with, I think, a wealth of information, extremely beneficial. I thank you. When we get into, if hopefully we get into the legislative mode where we take the, blueprint that comes out of here, is White Sands going to be available to give their expertise and testimony in the legislative process?
We can make that recommendation. I think that's to be determined. I don't know how we could answer that right now.
Then my comment is that I believe they have given this committee more information, certainly I'm speaking for myself, than I have ever had through this process. And I think without the type of expertise, we would be depriving our representatives of the information they need to make a good decision on this process.
Thank you.
I support sort of the chair's view of this. I think we need to write the report in a way where people understand the impact of their decision. If they want to have a tax rate like Twin Rivers does, you're going to get a certain type of facility. With 75% or whatever it is they tax there, it's very high. If you go to a lower tax rate, you're likely to get something bigger, even if you don't put a minimum investment in, although I think, you may want to do that. You may want to put a minimum in there. But I don't feel my role is to make those decisions for the legislature. I agree with Senator Rausch. It would be nice if they're available to support our report and maybe answer questions on it. I'd hope that could happen because I think it would be useful. I know, having been through a commission previously, some of this information isn't all that new to me, but I did get educated about it, and it's not all intuitive necessarily, so I think it would be helpful for legislators, but I don't think we should make those ultimate decisions. I think we should be educated and informed, and the legislature can make its decision if it wants to proceed.
Representative Weber.
Well, I like the approach as well. One of the things that I've been grappling with in my own mind without really discussing it with anybody is what I refer to as the chicken and the egg problem. Normally, when you do regulation, you have a statute, and then you write the regulations based on what the statute says. And for us, And we're dancing around the issue of not having this commission make the giant policy decisions like one facility, two facilities, zero facilities, what the exact tax rate is. And so there isn't a statute to work off of to set the regulations. And I think that the framework that Chairman Ames is talking about allows us to come up with a framework for regulation and basically leave blanks for the major policy decisions. And I think both, logically and also politically, and I don't mean that politically in a political party sort of way, I just mean as a way of presenting something to the legislature, it makes it clearer to legislators who are voting on a structure. It makes it clearer to them that they will have another bite at the policy apple, that they can then clearly set those policy goals in another vehicle. And I think that may be a little stretch to explain it to begin with, but I think ultimately it makes sense to me is the only way you can really get your arms around those, separating out those two things. So, I'm for it.
Any other thoughts on this question? Attorney Sullivan.
So, my head's still a little foggy because I had a head cold, so I'm not sure I'm clear on what we're doing.
Maybe you stayed up too late.
I have to thank the Red Sox for winning and ending the policy award ceremony by midnight. So, sort of pulling together what you all said, we would, with respect to, we would not say in our report recommendations that there should be one casino and five, 20 slot machine facilities or whatever, anything like that. But what we would do, though, is say, if there is a gambling facility, these are the regulations that should pertain to the hiring, the background checks, and those types of things. We're not going to make a decision as to perhaps what the governing structure is, as to who's overseeing the regulation, but whether it's lottery, whether it's a new commission, whatever it should be. However, we would recommend that the membership be blah, 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 that there may be, perhaps you want a compensated board, you know, but not put that in as part of the regulation, perhaps make those as sort of like recommendations, so that we almost have a couple of different pieces. Is that what I'm feeling, that we're going to have some sort of education, we're going to have some blanks that the legislature will obviously have to decide their major policy decisions. But we're going to make, but if we do this, if we have a casino, these are the regulations that should apply. But are we also going to have sort of something else that says, and by the way, although we would also recommend you look at, you know, that if we're going to have an oversight commission, what the oversight commission should have.
Well, I think, I'd like to respond to that. I think I'm talking about a very narrow set of choices that would be deferred to the legislature by language that would say to be determined by the mm-hmm. general court.
Yeah.
And that narrow set is fiscal okay. and capacity and okay. number. Capacity, I mean by capacity number. There is an underlying presumption to everything we're doing, that we're talking about a casino. Yeah. That's what the legislation has called on us to speak to. So what is a casino? I think the understanding was a significant facility, without defining that at all, or set of facilities. So this whole effort we're engaged in doesn't make any sense if we're talking about a couple of small resort-based slot locations. We're talking about the potential of having a casino. That will be decided ultimately by the legislature. And I'm saying for a narrow set of choices, we will have language in the legislation that will defer that choice to the legislature. I'm not saying we'll defer on the agency structure.
Okay.
We will make those choices. We need to make those choices, and that's coming up. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, I would agree with that. I think those narrow items you're talking about, fiscal and capacity, those type of issues, I think we should defer. But I think one of our core missions of this authority is the structure.
Absolutely.
And I think we need to deal with that.
Senator Ramsch?
I concur. I think I'm on the same page, but as I look through the documentation, especially the one as far as legislative proposals, White Sands has given us a whole series of recommendations. And as I see it, in have read through this, these recommendations really pertain to the regulatory side of it. And they're not trying to tell us you need to have two or... So I look at this one particular document as a key component to guide us with 152 omnibus and these recommendations. How that is compiled, I guess, dump onto the chairman here, but I like what has come out of this document.
I think we're absolutely on the same page, and all of that detail that you're talking about needs to be addressed, folded into, or not folded into, some we may alter, you know, whatever, we'll make our judgments on this, into a bill, draft legislation. That's our mandate, to draft legislation that addresses the prospect of having a casino in New Hampshire. And the one thing we won't do or defer upon is the narrow set of choices, which is a very narrow part of what's in that document. I think we're absolutely on the same page. And how we're going to do it, as I explained before, we're going to go through this discussion today and next week. At the end of that, there should be enough direction for, I expect that I, working with White Sands, will develop that draft bill and the draft report, which becomes super important in the context of that narrow set of choices. We've got to lay out those parameters in a clear way, make as clear as we can the consequences of going this way, let's say on capital investment, or this way, and how that affects tax rate. To show that this is a set of choices that interact one with the other.
From the racing and gaming perspective, we will agree with you. I think the outline is very well put together, Mr. Chairman. We'll participate.
Good. So I think we're all on the same page on that, and that's how we'll proceed on the fiscal incapacity thing. And that includes that we will come back and be looking at something that may suit your fancy or may not. So we'll get to that point later on. All right? Good. That's excellent. Thank you so much for your presentation and all this excellent information. I couldn't agree more with Senator Rausch and his comments on what you've brought to the table on this process. It's really been fantastic. All right, we're moving along, maybe a little more slowly than hoped, but we're moving. We talked last week about regulatory agency options, and I'm speaking now to the question of how other states have managed the casino enterprise in conjunction with other gambling, how it's been set up structurally. I did prepare a set of charts to help guide our discussion, so I'm going to pass them out. So on the first page here is what we have now. This is a very rough chart. Please understand that my computer skills go only so far. And this chart does not show relationships out to the Attorney General, state police, local police, liquor enforcement. It doesn't have any of that surrounding world that affects what happens in the gambling world. And in our existing system, we've got the Lottery Commission, we've got the Racing and Charitable Gaming Commission. You all know it quite well. Lottery Commission has three part-time commissioners, does rulemaking, does the adjudication, and conducts hearings. Its executive director is here with us, and under the statute is responsible for the operation of the Granite State Lottery. Under the statute, I think it's in the statute, it may be in the regulations, there are two subparts to the office. One is lottery games management, lottery finance and administration, and then it goes out to the field that we see. And there's a lot left out of that chart. I'm sure Director McIntyre could fill it in more, but right now I'm just trying to keep at the very simple level so that we can think about options. Racing and Charitable Gaming has six part-time commissioners, does all the rulemaking at that level, and the adjudication hearings, headed by a director who's with us and who runs the administrative office, and that then goes out to the field with the licensees, operators, and so forth, charities. So that's the existing. If you go to page two, I attempted to chart the, it's just a schematic, to chart the SB 152 proposal, which had the, and now I'm narrowing the scope down even more so that the most Racing and Charitable Gaming Commission is not on this page. It wasn't part of the 152 omnibus proposal for the most part. And you've got the Lottery Commission still the same, three part-time commissioners. Added to it now is the casino rulemaking. Added to it is the casino licensing. Added to it is the ongoing process of adjudicating and conducting hearings on issues. And down underneath the commission is its executive director. And now he or she has picked up the function of regulating the casino and overseeing casino operations. And under the SB 152 proposal, there was a added to the administrative structure under the executive director. There was a Bureau of Administration and Enforcement. I put the word casino in front of that to differentiate it. That's intended for the casinos by SB 152, and SB 152 then had that bureau pointing out to the field and to the casino licensee, or in that case it was just a casino licensee, single licensee, and all of the operations there. There was also a line out to the field that runs through the executive director and up to the lottery commission. There is in 152B, in addition, charitable games of chance that would, under the scheme of 152B, 152 Omnibus, report to and be supervised by Racing and Charitable Gaming Commission. So it would have to be charitable games of chance on the floor in the casino that's licensed under the 152B, 152O scheme, and those games of chance would be supervised by Racing and Charitable Gaming. That's the scheme, more or less, in a very simple sense of 152. Go to the next page, and the third and fourth pages are in broad stroke again, a couple of options, moving beyond the 152 omnibus concept. In this scheme, the lottery commission is reconstituted. The legislation would do that if this option were chosen, it would rename it the Lottery and Gaming Commission, expand its commissioner number to 5, one of whom would be full-time under this model and would chair the commission, would be appointed as such. That commission would have these functions, lottery and casino rulemaking, casino licensing, lottery and casino adjudication and hearings. The chair is a full-time person would run the central office, and any central services that could serve the functions below could be directly under the chair. The lottery would report through the chair to the commission. The casino gaming, likewise, each headed by executive director. The lottery would be essentially the same organization is currently, except that what lies above it would be a little different, and casino would report up to the chair on a separate line, separate from the lottery. And I also have on this model a line out for a director of research and responsible gaming as a way of sort of heightening the importance of that concept, reporting directly to the chair. That would be simply a function that did not reach out into the field. That's similar to the Massachusetts model. Tied into the Lottery and Gaming Commission on an advisory level only, without decision-making authority, would be an entity. I use the Gaming Regulatory Oversight Authority name that we have, but it would be reconstituted, and it would have an advisory role with respect to all that the Lottery and Gaming Commission is looking out at. I should add that it would be possible under this model to also combine under a single commission racing and charitable gaming. Whether that's a good idea or not is something we can discuss, or whether any of this is a good idea we can discuss. And if you go to the fourth page, this is a stand on your own feet gaming commission model. You have lottery as it is, you have racing and charitable gaming as it is, and you have a new gaming commission. That is self-explanatory, I think. It's just I used the same material that I had on the previous page, but put it in just a gaming commission. So I've got these three models out there. They're intended to facilitate discussion and decision-making on this organizational challenge that we've got that do not reflect necessarily my opinion one way or the other. I just put them out on the floor. So we need some discussion. Senator Roush.
I think key to the, I'm not sure yet I have in my head, but I think key to the success or at least moving forward of any piece of legislation are where are the gentlemen to my right and left, how do they tie into this so that at a minimum they're at least comfortable, and I don't have in my head yet how that works. Do we have a in this process yet? I mean, I certainly have heard where White Sands is. Do we use their information, or are we going to just get input from the safety and attorney general's office? I don't know yet how we wrap this together with those two agencies.
I'll certainly let them speak for themselves. I think just a few words that's the easy part of it, their relationship to whatever model we have here. But it's very important. We need to specify that. There are some choices. There's a real need to clarify what was stated in 152 and about the relationship between the two and the relationship to the regulatory agency. But I think that there's no difference of opinion on how we're to do that. But let's hear from Attorney General.
Can I just add one other thing?
Yes.
In light of the information that has come out and the recommendations about the charitable gaming, the model of 152 and Omnibus, where charitable gaming was allowed within the casinos, I would have to say until we resolve the issues that White Sands has brought up, I would agree with their proposal, their recommendation, that the charitable gaming not be mixed within a legalized casino environment, because we have two separate regulatory, unless we manage to get one regulatory, I would not want to mix those two gaming entities.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, I'll open it up to comment on,
yes,
on these different proposals.
Yes,
I agree with the Senator. I don't think you should be mixing, a charitable right inside a facility, a commercial facility, so I agree. Out of the ones that I'm not anchored on any what I'm about to say, but my first look at this.
Let me just say one other thing. I should have prefaced my remarks saying we're not going to reach a decision on this today. We're talking about it. We're trying to make sure we understand the range of options. We may express opinions, but as a group, we're not. I think we have to make a decision, a preliminary decision on the direction we need to take on organization next week. But today, let's see what. Let's talk about it.
Out of the options that are listed here, these options, the one I'm drawing is on page. This would be page 3. Page 3.
Yeah.
Again, to the issue of enforcement and regulation, I would look at the details as far as the Attorney General and the State Police and the role they would play in the regulatory and enforcement process would be under the Executive Director of Gaming, Casino Gaming and Administration and Enforcement. And I think that certainly the details would have to be worked out. But I see this model, I like it. I think of my own department, we're very diverse, we're very large. We have 7 different divisions. Even though they're diverse, they all have a common theme of public safety. And what I also like about this is to at least consider the possibility of including a director of charitable gaming. Racing and charitable gaming, I think that could be considered within this model. The reason I say that is that even though, and I do agree with White Sands, that racing and charitable gaming, we should not try to fix all the issues related to that here. It's just going to to, it's going to, I think, keep us from our primary mission here, charge. However, I think to look at including them within at least the structure, I think it would get that part right. I think it would allow us to, down the road or in parallel, but and separate, to at least start to look at charitable gaming in the context of the gaming that we have in the state and all the issues and problems we have with unregulated gaming in the state. My concern is if they're not included in the model, that we're going to be looking at this 5 years from now, and we're going to have the same problems with unregulated or not improperly or not complete regulation of some of these areas. So I like this model. I think you could look at adding on a director for racing and charitable gaming. Reason being, the words are, I see consistency, uniformity. I think it would bring healthy communication and dialogue amongst those somewhat diverse areas of lottery, somewhat diverse areas of lottery, commercial gaming, and charitable gaming. So I think it would also reduce duplication and redundancy. And most importantly, I think it would lead to communication and coordination.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So,
I am drawn to 3 or 4. I think with 3, I agree with a lot of what the commissioner said. I guess that's sort of more of a gloss on my thinking on it. I would see this full-time chair as likely some individual from New Hampshire who's the public has great confidence in, a public figure, a well-known business individual, or somebody with a high level of integrity that people have great confidence in, and that the two executive directors for lottery, we have a great one for the casino gaming. I think we do a national search for an individual who's very experienced, who can bring the skill set of running a casino, who has that experience. It is a different business than we've done in New Hampshire before. So I view those as, you know, sort of two separate parts of the commission, I guess it would be. And I think expanding to another 4 commissioners from 3 could make some good sense with the staggered terms that we have and from the part-time basis. I hadn't thought about the racing and charity union as being part of this, but I could see that it could fit in fairly easily because we are having these sort of separate roles. I like the idea of the director of research and responsible gaming. I think it creates an importance of that that would continue because it would be there and moving forward. So I think it's a decent model. And still having them linked would create some efficiencies. Mr. Bachmus could tell us what efficiencies it is. As large as your agency is, I imagine there's some sharing of resources within their human resources, some other sorts of parts of the agency that you would have that would create some efficiencies. We are only maybe going to have 1 or 2 properties in New Hampshire. If we were going to a larger number, maybe you want to have a totally separate agency. Those are my thoughts.
Attorney Sullivan.
I agree with the commissioner and the general.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
I agree
Start
with
again.
Both the commissioner and the general. I think that the one shown on page 3, and I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your excellent work on this, because it really sort of crystallizes my thought process throughout this, is that it makes sense to not start totally from scratch, because we do have some folks in place and some processes in place. But yet, at the same time, we're not bound to stick with what we have now and trying to graft on top of it. Let's sort of build from where we are. I like the idea of also, because the commission suggested, including charitable and gaming and their director as a department within this overall structure. One of the things I have really come to learn a lot about in this process is the charitable gaming. And that it's gambling. We have a large gambling business in the state, and I think it makes sense if we're going to have a lottery and gaming commission that all of this be included within this one agency. I also was struck by some of the review in the White Sands reports about qualifications for commissioners, and I would like to us to talk about as we go through the process having requirements for the commissioner so that you do have someone who has law enforcement background, someone with legal background, someone with lottery background, you know, that we have sort of, we have some qualifications for some of the members of the commission, and then perhaps you also have, so a, I guess a public member who doesn't need to have those particular qualifications. But that way, we are assured of having folks who are all providing oversight with experience and expertise in very important areas, perhaps of, you know, requiring a CPA, you know, those types of things that we saw referenced in the White Sands reports for some states that have those types of requirements. So I like what we have here on page 3, and that's the direction that I would like us to see us go in.
Thank you.
Not to put you and representative on the Weber on the hook, but I guess I would be very interested to get some feedback from the House members on, I guess, where you see the House at, because obviously the Senate passed 152, and I mean, I will admittedly now certainly say that we passed that without the appropriate regulations as I see this coming forward. So, and again, I want to compliment White Sands because they have been a wealth of information for me. And that said, though, the House produced Omnibus, and we find that even Omnibus wasn't where you would want it to be. So I'm very interested in the take as you see it from the House side.
Always dangerous to speak for the House, isn't it?
I would take that, and I would preface my remarks by saying I have no idea what the House will ultimately do with this. The considerations that I see is certainly there were House members who were very concerned about the lack of regulation, which gets us back into the chicken and the egg problem. How do you regulate when you don't know what you're regulating? But I think we have some real credible ways of addressing some of that. So that will be a help. I think that the other thing that will be very helpful, as it was for all of us, for the House members who really want to learn more about the process, is having the White Sands report and having independent, industry knowledgeable advice that was given to us in the context of our regulatory process rather than in the context of I'm working for a developer and let me tell you the best way to do it is our way. So I think for some people that will be very useful information to have as long as in the decision making process. You also have people who have their minds made up and will not change no matter what. I think the other trade-off that you run into in the House a lot is we have sort of three groups. The I don't want expanded gambling at any point. You have the I will only vote for one facility people. And you also have the I will only vote for more than one facility people. And how you balance out the I will only vote for more than one people with a governor who has made very clear that the governor wants one facility. And I don't know how much movement there is on the parts of anybody there. So that's all a long way of saying those are the considerations you have to look at when you look at the House, but I don't really have any idea where they're going with that. I will say that the other thing from my perspective that is very important to communicate to the House, and I think probably from yours to the Senate, is that my underlying assumptions about charitable gaming in the state of New Hampshire were very wrong. And I go to the information sessions when we have information sessions, and I listen to people, and I listen to the efforts of the people who are doing the omnibus amendment to resolve the differing interests of the charitable gaming, the charitable game proceeds recipients, and all of that with what's coming in. And I think the House needs more information about that, but again, what direction the House will ultimately take is very different. And I applaud the White, I agree with the White Sands recommendation that we really need to look at these as two different proposals, and it certainly was the charge to this committee that we look at them as two separate things. But it occurs to me that we may or may not choose to do, I mean, I think it's probably a mistake to try and change the charitable sides of things in whatever we do about expansion. But I think that we may wind up perhaps coming out with the suggestion of two separate bills, one of which is the regulatory structure and one which addresses the first part of our charge, which is the current regulation, appropriate level of regulation of what we've got now. And I don't know whether we'll go there or not, but I think that it's something to bear in mind.
All right.
That didn't help, I know, but...
Well, no one can predict what the House will do, but I think that the game has changed, to use casino terminology, in that there's better information. We are better informed. The House will be better informed as we go forward with this, and the information goes to the thoroughness, depth, the sufficiency of the regulatory proposal that we're going to develop. So I'm hopeful that the learning process will go on and lead to a good conclusion. I guess that's a way of saying where I'm at very vaguely. I think we're all set on this score. We will try to... I get the drift of the commission right now, but of the authorities right now, but we'll see if we're still drifting in the same way on next Wednesday. All right. On problem gambling, this can be quick, I think. We had a terrific presentation, I thought, last week, yeah, on problem gambling, and then Representative Weber and I spent all day at a forum in Boston convened by the Mass Gaming Commission on responsible gaming. They had there quite an impressive array of speakers and people in the audience. All five Massachusetts commissioners were there all day, basically listening. The chair spoke briefly at the beginning. They had there, I don't know the right title, the president, executive director of the American Gaming Association, who was in the audience all day long, and the general counsel of the American Gaming Association presented. They had leading researchers in problem gaming from around the country and from Canada. Some of the big names that are familiar to those people who've looked into problem gaming, Goldberg, Lidus, Ladusur, is that the right name? I think so. And from the National Association on Problem Gaming, the president of that or the director of that was also there. So a very interesting group of people with a lot to say about this issue and a lot of enthusiasm about the work that will be possible in Massachusetts under the umbrella of the Massachusetts statute. I think, and also a lot of talk, of course, about the issue of problem gambling. I came back from that just as I came away from the presentation the other day that it reaffirmed both as to the importance of this issue that we can't just leave it be and hope that things will work out. We have to address it. I think the omnibus looking at it in the last few days has some very good provisions on problem gambling. Picking up on Senator Rausch's point, I think I have learned more in this process, and I see now there are a few things more that we could do. So the plan that I have is to fold into the drafting process to pick up, do some tweaking on the omnibus amendment provisions, and maybe pick up some provisions about research and maybe something else, who knows. I would go through it and approach the task of drafting on problem gaming in that spirit. Representative Weber, you might like to add something.
I just wanted to emphasize how interested I was in the concept of research and how little research there is out there, and how impressed I was by the fact that Massachusetts is going to invest a significant amount of money in establishing baseline information about not only levels of problem gaming, but pre-existing prior to the casinos coming in, but also within a certain geographical area of each new location, employment statistics, crime statistics, traffic statistics, other things about all the possible negative impacts of expanded gaming. So with a focus on, you want to, on one hand, maximize the benefit, and on the other hand, minimize the harm. And so they're front-loading the resources into research to begin with to establish a baseline of what is happening now in each of the chosen locations, and to use as information going forward both about what changes over time with respect to the locations, how to mitigate any unfavorable impacts, how to quantify favorable impacts, and also to use that data as a beginning point as the casinos and facilities come online, as to a way to look at what mitigation measures that you might take within a casino or within a community in terms of deterring problem gaming along with all the other stuff. Obviously, we're not going to have that same kind of budget to put in, but we're very much a continuum in that our people will continue going to Massachusetts and Massachusetts will continue coming here. They certainly have documented, I think it was 300 or so calls a year to their problem gaming lines from people who are gaming in Massachusetts but actually live in New Hampshire. So the effects will cross lines, and I think having the same kind of thoughts in our heads at a more appropriate scale to New Hampshire, I think, is a very important thing going forward.
Yeah, that's an important point. This is one issue where it really is helpful to have regulatory schemes that are congruent, so that the problem gamblers in New Hampshire, the problem gamblers in Massachusetts, the reaching out to that group, the prevention of problem gambling, can all be sort of part of a whole rather than in different balkanized units.
And if I may add to that, the other thing that, of course, really concerns me is currently we've got plenty of gambling and we're doing nothing in this sphere at all. Zero. So anything that enables us to get from a place of doing nothing to doing something, given that we already have the problem, would be really helpful as far as I'm concerned.
Yes.
If I could, only because we do a tremendous amount of research already on every aspect of gambling in the state. Just that we could delineate the functions of the person, if indeed there is one, to not include all research and keep that thought for going forward, only because director of responsible gambling might make some sense. Director of research responsible gambling, if you're going to have number on page 3 be your guiding light, is going to be in conflict with what I believe to be the chair and most of the authorities' viewpoint on responsible gaming.
I guess it's a matter of definition. The research will be focused on the problem.
Well, exactly. Like, if it's a question of what the authority, the commission in Mass is doing, it's clearly research towards problem gambling.
Yeah.
We have tremendous amounts of research every year based off of demographic studies and baseline studies and the rest that we use internally for our own.
Correct.
So I don't want to have the two be mixed in terms of, you know, a research function.
Good point. Yeah. Any other thoughts on this subject? The plan on problem gaming is to proceed and build off of what we've learned, but also off of Senate Bill 152 omnibus provisions. And again, on an exception basis, if there's anything you see in Senate Bill 152 related to problem gaming that you don't like, or anything else that you do like, bring it forward. Otherwise, we'll just work off of what we got. All right? Okay, let's see. What does that bring us down to? Other expanded gaming regulatory issues. I think, Attorney Williamson, you hadn't finished going through what you had prepared, and I think what you hope to do is to go through the to highlight some of your recommendations and bring them to our attention.
Exactly.
So we can act on them.
Thank you. All of you have the 213 legislative proposal. It's Area 2. And there were a number of recommendations in here. A number of them were
maybe take 1 second, make sure we've all got the recording on.
So it's Area 2 legislative Area 2. Proposals exactly. Rather than Area 2 fiscal and capacity requirements.
Yeah.
Thank you. And this was the section that basically summarized the legislative proposals that were entertained in the 213 session, both House bills. And the Senate bill. And as I said in the introduction here, the study of all of them is very important and very illustrative, because you do see in the examination of all of them really core policy decisions, core perspectives, and things that concepts that were better developed as the process went forward. And so as we concluded, as a predicate for doing the report, Senate Bill 152, the omnibus version, was a version that was a really structurally and conceptually, it's a good basis for starting the work that the authority is charged with. And the expectation is that with the consideration of a number of these recommendations, that you would have the framework to create an enabling statute that fully articulated a comprehensive regulatory scheme. What the hope is that at the end of this process, your report will have attached to it a proposed piece of legislation that would address all of the key regulatory concepts, and then the regulatory process would simply be filling out the concepts that are already identified, and to a certain degree, the policy decisions will have been made at the statutory level, and the regulations will simply flow from them. So, for example, using a simple example, you may have the statute will say that there will be rulemaking for minimum security and surveillance staffing. And so it will be clear that there will be those minimum requirements for a surveillance and security function. Your regulations will get into the fact that you will need one surveillance monitor for every 12,000 square foot of casino space, or every 250 slot machines, or whatever. However way you decide to approach that by regulation, but the core concept will have been in the statute. So what I thought I would do this morning, unless any of the authority members have specific questions about any of the recommendations, we could go right to that. But if in lieu of that, I thought I would just highlight a few that I think are really, really core and require some discussion. Senator Rausch has already brought up the first issue, and that's the recommendation number one. It's on page 15 of the document, that you not integrate, physically integrate the games of chance into any expanded gaming sector at this time. And I think we've discussed that with a great deal of specificity, so unless there's a particular question on that, I would move forward from that. The second recommendation that I think is really a corollary of that, and that is recommendation two, again at 15, and this was a recommendation that you consider whether or not you want to take any type of, whether you want to address charitable organizations in the context of this legislation. The omnibus bill had a concept of a charitable benefit concept that basically looked at a charitable organization and where they were positioned, you know, pre-expanded gaming and post-expanded gaming, and attempted to basically compensate them for that. I think under all the facts and circumstances, that may be a very convoluted and difficult to administer approach. I think you can, in lieu of that, look at something that's a little cleaner, where a portion, say, of table game revenue would be, you know, just for the sake of discussion, that you would take, for example, 1% of table game revenue and put that in a fund where charitable organizations, whether or not they currently participate, could step forward and basically on an annual basis, and based on what they're going to do with the funds, basically compete for an award from this fund. So I would say, basically, you know, there are a number of ways you can do that, but I think what you want to look at in an enabling statute is that if you're going to have any type of compensation for charitable, that it be more in terms of a fund allocation.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
May I?
Sorry. My eye is just looking down. I wasn't looking up.
Okay. I thank you, and I don't know if you know, but I am the senator who wrote that provision. So I will now very humbly say that it was an effort to resolve a problem, and in light of a lot of the information you have presented, I will change my ways, and I would probably not recommend that provision be in future legislation until we have, we need to resolve all the areas you brought up about charitable gaming before I would ever propose that, whatever we do to help them, whether it's 1%, but basically I'm humbly saying I would retract that.
Well, again, and I mean, we've certainly all been there with drafting, and I know it was the best of intentions. And I think the thing is that if you approach charitable and any expanded concept on a parallel track, then you have time to examine that. And you have time to actually know better what the actual impact is. So, again, I think that was something that we've had a lot of discussion on. I think things are clearer with that.
Okay, Attorney Sullivan has a question.
It's really a comment. And I understand where Senator Rausch was coming from, because we've heard at the public hearings a number of folks came in and testified about the importance to their organizations of the funds that are now received from charitable gaming. I've talked to some people outside of here who have said to me, your organizations depend on the money they get from charitable gaming. They don't do their fundraising anymore, or they do a little fundraising, and the bulk of their operating monies now come from these things, especially the smaller groups. So I do like the idea of having some sort of a hold harmless for a couple of reasons. One, because these people are going to suffer some loss of revenue. Also, I don't know the politics of this in the legislature, whether or not, if you don't have a hold harmless of some kind, whether or not this passes, because these charitable groups, obviously,
they're the friends and neighbors of the legislators and your clients saying, what are you doing to us? At the same time, they also need to be realistic that with what's coming down the pike in Massachusetts, they're going to be injured since so many of them are in the southern part of the state if we do nothing. So I think it's important for us to have some recommendation of some kind. It could be some, and I like the idea perhaps of a percentage of revenue set aside for a charitable nonprofit fund. I'm not quite sure how that should be administered. Again, do we reward those who are participating now to the detriment of those who have not, maybe stuck on a waiting list? Or those, what happens if some of these organizations, you know, disappear in the future and all the rest of that? I mean, that's there's a lot to think about with respect to such a fund. But I think we need to address it because there will be an impact, and B, if we don't, I think we have problems down the line in getting a successful legislation through. I see Representative Weber's nodding, so.
Wish I had a magic answer to how to do it.
Yes, sir.
I mean, we can think about, too, if that 1% model is the model to go, how to miss those funds. There are ways we can look at doing things like that. We can look at, I take an example, the average membership of charity, whatever that number is. Mm-hmm. We'll divide that number by some divisor that's maybe how much money they spend on how many clients, divided by how much money they spend on how many communities. So I think we can put together a formula that's probably wouldn't be too hard to put together if that was a purpose. And then again, but getting back to Attorney Sullivan's point, maybe some of that fund has to be already pre-allocated to those that have already had legacy in charitable giving. But I think there are ways to.
And just one more point on that. The way this looks to me, we're talking about this. These are small charities, I think, for the most part. They're the small nonprofits. And because at one point I thought, why not give money to New Hampshire Division of Charitable Trust, whatever, you know, and have them allocate as they do with, it's the Dean Foundation or whoever, grants. But those are the large charities in New Hampshire. These are the small,
mom and pop,
that's exactly right, the mom and pop charities who rely so heavily now. And we can quibble all day long about whether how we got to this point was good, whether it's a good situation, but that doesn't matter. It's a situation we're in, and we got to do something, I think, to protect those mom and pop charities that have come to rely so heavily on these dollars. So some, we got to do something.
Attorney General, question.
This is more of a question. I think I asked it early on, and I don't recall the answer. Say hypothetically, the casino is passed, and it doesn't end up in Rockingham for a moment, which I think is where one of the larger charitable and operations.
Well, the primary game locations, correct.
Do we have any idea what the impact of adopting a commercial casino would be on the existing charitable operations statewide? And there's probably no way to really figure that out, is there? But everybody says it'll have a big impact, but the bets are way lower, the clientele might be different. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, because there's a presumption, obviously, with the 1% or whatever else we're doing, that there is an adverse impact.
Imagine for sure that. I looked at that a little bit to see what would happen. And there is a positive outcome that could become of that. If we looked at Senator Rauch's amendment, typically the charity's going to get $13 million was their safeguard they're going to get. If we look at a casino, at that point in time, there'd be charitable gaming going on. Since the traffic flow would be so increased at that location, there was a sense that perhaps charitable gaming revenue would actually increase at that location. Now, let's just say the way the legislation was written last year, every charity in the state could actually participate at that one location, Rockingham Park, by just doing one day. The statute was silent on the minimum days to qualify for that $13 million. But it did say the maximum days was 10. So if every charity in the state went to Rockingham Park for one day, typically we could almost get all the charities in the state to go to Rockingham Park. What that do to the other primary game operator locations, they all have waiting lists. Now all those other charities now come off waiting lists, and now they have some place to participate in charitable giving. It's just, when you say how does it affect Rockingham, there's two ways of looking at it. It could be very good for charities, because there'll be so much more money coming into that location. Then you could look at, I had thought that had that bill flown last year, an amendment you might look at, is that it says you could have up to two charities per day. Well, if the revenue streams were that positive, maybe we could allow four charities per day. And so more charities would be getting that revenue from charitable gaming at that location.
So if I was asking the flip, though, what if the casino is not at Rockingham so that the existing facilities are not forced to effectively go out of business, which I assume the one at Rockingham would, unless you do this, you know, with Center Rush had in mind or something else. Would they shrivel anyway?
Well, I think if I'm hearing, let's just say the operation now, let's just put it in Hampton Beach, for example, all right, completely away from that. It's still going to be a crowd enhancer. People are going to go there to play. And I think that the charities that are concentric to that location will do very well. And it really doesn't make a difference, I think, is it Rockingham or Hampton Beach. You're going to have that influx of people coming. You had the $13 million guarantee, and you're going to have more charitable gambling going on the location. Maybe I'm missing it.
I guess what I'm asking is, let's say you didn't do anything, and I'm not recommending that. But let's say there's a commercial casino. I want to make it up. It's in Hudson or it's in Hampton Beach, and there's nothing in it for charitable gaming. What happens to the charitable gaming operations in New Hampshire? Do we know? Are they significantly adversely impacted, or they just continue?
I don't think we can put a number on that right now, but I just think logically that, I mean, how many people go to a charitable gaming location because of the charity that's there that day?
Probably not.
So now I have a commercial alternative, better games, definitely, more entertainment, more amenities. So I think it would take a hit. And I think it's supply and demand. If it was in your scenario at Rockingham, then those, that goes away. Yeah. Is it pure market demand? Does that go somewhere else and start at that location, or does it go away? So I it could be looked at, and I couldn't put a number on it today.
Attorney Sullivan, you've been patiently waiting.
Yeah.
I think, General, you got to assume the charitable gaming at Rockingham's gone. I just think you have to assume that, because if there's a casino there, in which case why would
there? Yeah, obviously. Yeah, no,
if there isn't a casino there, now I can't predict what the owners of Rockingham would do, but I think there's a pretty good chance they're out. They sell.
And they sell the property.
I mean, don't you think that's a very realistic?
Just for other development opportunities and so on.
Exactly. Yeah, that's an extremely,
either way,
that's a very valuable piece of real estate. Yeah. And other, obviously, the casino there makes it even more valuable. But if there's no casino, goes for some other purpose, and I think they're gone, and therefore we lose the charitable gaming anyway.
I wouldn't be surprised, Jim Sullivan, if Rockingham went up. I wouldn't be surprised if somebody came in and took a, and I don't know the geographic, all the places where the VFW hall or a big hall down there, and turned that into a charitable game.
At Rockingham?
In the Salem area.
Oh, and somebody else would come in and take their place. I got it.
I think because they at now what the third or fourth largest card room in New England, that there's a market there. Somebody would step in.
Got lots of hands here.
I was just going to add on to the remarks of Attorney Sullivan a couple of minutes ago about the complexity of dealing with what we have now, because there really isn't any consistent thought out there, and this comes back to the issues of getting things through the New Hampshire House, but I went recently to speak to a group of people about what's going on in the legislature, and we discussed this, and a lady sat there, and she was very firm about the global evils of gambling and how very, very bad it was for our state, and then said how nice it was that her charity of choice depends very highly on the revenues that they're getting. And she didn't see any disconnect between those two statements, and I think that there's an enormous amount of that out there. And we had some further discussion, but, you know, for a lot of people, that's those two things exist side by side, and that's difficult to cope with in terms of, and I think having more information out there is the best thing we can do about it, but lots of people are really good at keeping those disconnects anyway.
Attorney Williamson.
Well, the one thing that, you know, the one thing, Senator Rausch, your proposal was sound in that you were addressing actual impact. Mm-hmm. So you were looking for a demonstration of actual impact. And one thing that could be considered in this is just conceptually, but, you know, in specific situations, you know, in the Rockingham example, not all charities would be impacted, just a specific subset of charities, and maybe they are part of the local impact, that when you're looking at an allocation and a local impact, that the charities that are specifically impacted get a little slice of that pie, or maybe the local allocation is enhanced a little bit so that the charities are taken care of. It's just something to consider.
Interesting concept. Thank you.
I'm sorry, Senator Rausch.
I think he had his hand.
Well, I guess, again, the reason now that I have changed twofold, one is that I never had the realization that the existing charitable gaming with the table games was fraught with problems because it is so totally unregulated. That was not something I recognized. The other thing in that proposal was that a big part of it is what Mr. Kelly said, is that it did, in my head, incorporate the charitable gaming within a casino, which allowed for the expansion of the number of charities to help mitigate if there is any loss. But now, in light of what has come up, I now have taken the philosophy that charitable gaming should not be within that casino because we don't have the proper regulations. So I think charitable gaming isn't going to go away. Now, I disagree with if Rockingham goes away, we should have another charitable facility there. That's like, well, then we better legalize it because they're unregulated. So, but charitable gaming isn't going to go away, which is why somebody has to figure out how do we address the lack of regulation. But in the same sense, I agree with Attorney Sullivan, is that we don't want to harm those smallers. We have to find another mechanism, which I'm kind of thinking maybe a percent of revenue out of a legalized facility that is operated with all the regulations, and we don't dump the charities inside of it.
That's good. I think that's a good concept. It really flows. It's consistent with your concept. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Look at impact and provide for coverage through the revenues. That's basically what I'm hearing. Yeah.
Just one quick question for Director Kelly on impact. Do you have a model, I mean, as far as these local gaming locations, how far they draw from? I mean, do you have a radius that you can look at, whether it's Rockingham or some of the other larger facilities?
We can look at it. I have no empirical data I can share with you, but I can share what we do when we visit our facilities. If you go to the facilities in Manchester, 99% of the license plates are New Hampshire plates, obviously. But as you go down to Seabrook, Hampton Falls, in Rockingham, about 80 to 90% of the plates are Massachusetts license plates. So that's what I can tell you with the drawing areas. The lower tier of the state, you're drawing from out of state. The upper tier, you're drawing from New Hampshire residents.
I think the other question, though, is what about the charities?
Charities that are assigned by the state has no role in picking those charities. So it's up to each primary game operator to make a decision on what charity they want to select. Some facilities, typically Rockingham Park comes to mind. They try to do the local charities first, Salem Boys Club, Girls Clubs, and then they branch out once the local charities have been satisfied. In other areas of the state, it's not necessarily the case. You could have, in Hampton Falls, you can have, you know, the support for the charities come down, but you have some of the North Country come down just as well. We don't control that. The state has no control on that.
Let me follow up on that. Do you have data on that?
Well, I can tell you what they're all from the state.
You have the names of the charities.
Oh, yes, we can provide that.
And do you have, how much money is going into charity from charitable gaming?
About $13 million.
About $13 million a year?
Net.
Net.
That's Bingo, Lucky 7, and Games of Chance.
Can you separate that?
Yeah.
Bingo, Lucky 7,
yes, sir,
versus Games of Chance?
Commissioner, for your benefit, when this first started, they couldn't even get people, charities to come. They had to advertise, they had to go out, they had to solicit. And now, once it caught on, it grew, and now everybody wants it. Like anything, it's been successful. A lot of smaller charities have wanted to come into it. That's why there's such a long waiting list. But I think Mr. Newman has stressed that he hired somebody when he was up at Belmont. Hire somebody to go out and solicit organizations to come to participate in.
Yes,
and not trying to be on the defense here at all, but what the Senator's Roush that is a totally unregulated area. It's interesting to note that in 2006, when charitable gaming, was Game of Chance came to the Charitable Gaming Commission. It came from all the local communities throughout the state, and it came with zero rules, zero regulations, and zero resources. And actually, I went from 5 inspectors down to 3. So I feel that, but we were chipping everywhere, coming before you, trying to get more rules and regulations in. It's just, it's a resource-based model.
Well, you shouldn't feel defensive about that. I think that's the reality, and we all know that, and acknowledge that right up front.
Could I just ask one financial question? On the model you gave on revenues, did you have 1% in that?
No.
No. So the $91 million, quickly in my head, 1% rounded to 100, that's $10 million. If you did 1%, if you had $100 million, 1% is $10 million. So 1% of...
Of the total.
Right. Well, that was just a concept that I threw out in terms of one of the reasons why I looked at table game revenue was that I believe that at 14% that was in the omnibus bill was a low table game tax assessment. So, you know, I think, Jim, the range that we recommended you consider was maybe between 14 and 18. So you could pick up, you could keep the 14 for the general fund and maybe pick up another 1, 2, 3% for the charities and still be bringing to the table a competitive tax rate on table games. So that was just, again, that wasn't something that we spent a lot of time on. But something that where I knew you had basically some slack.
To clarify, I think the first model was 30 and 14, and then 35 and 18, which was, we felt were ranges that you could operate between.
Okay,
thank you.
So it wouldn't have to be, you know, it would be in addition to, you wouldn't be taking it out of one pot to put it in another. It could be some fresh pot.
All right, let's continue.
One of the things I wanted to just touch on, it's a technical topic, it's page 18, recommendation number 5. In taxation on gaming, in recent years, there's been a move to exempt or not include in the calculation of gross revenue credits that are advanced as incentives to customers. And so it is a way of dealing with tax rates, and you have recommended a very, what's become the standard approach, so I would urge you to conclude that non-cashable promotional credits are deductible. I think that's something that's important for you to include because it will be a competitive and what's really becoming the industry standard. Next concept I wanted to talk about, and I think, again, this is on page 23, it's part of recommendation number 10, which really has a really just looks at the omnibus generally and some things for tightening, is the concept that if you unbundle the charitable gaming from any type of normal or standard table game operation. I think another thing that should be stripped out of any future legislation is this concept of a primary game operator or a primary game operator employer. These are concepts that go with the charitable gaming piece. A casino operator, the operation of the table games is what they do. And so, you know, in any action going forward, I think you would authorize video lottery terminals and table games at the same time. You would not have a separate table game certification. A lot of states where you see table game certification are Pennsylvania and Maryland, where they had slots for a number of years before they moved on to table games. So they needed a mechanism for authorizing an existing licensee to offer table games. I think in any legislative proposal that you would authorize table games and video lottery terminals or slot machines concurrently, and you would strip out those concepts because an operator will operate their own table game operation, and you do not want them subcontracting that operation out to another entity. You can put a provision in for a management company. There, that is sometimes done, but where there is a management company, a best practice is that that management company would be licensed to the exact same standard as a casino operator. So I think we probably would, again, strip that concept out. Another issue that was underdeveloped in the omnibus bill is with regard to employees. The omnibus bill spoke in terms of licensing key employees, and it spoke in terms of a registration of non-key gaming employees. Typically, you want to capture, everyone captures the key employee. These are the persons who are in supervisory positions with an ability to really control the operation. Then you want to have a mechanism for really capturing some bit of information, I believe, about all employees. And so where they are gaming-related employees, meaning they're cashiers, they're IT people, they're dealers, they are people who have access to funds or an ability to impact revenue, that you would want to have either a licensing or a registration requirement for them. And then for the balance of the employees, you still want to have a basic registration requirement. You still want to have at least a police, background, not a background check, but a criminal history check for those people. Because you will have classes of persons like facilities people that companies that have cleaning contracts, or people that are doing cleaning and maintenance, but they still need to be in account room. They need to be in an IT section room. They need to be in the cashier's cage, even if they're doing carpentry or things of this nature. So you want to have a registration process for them so you know who they are and that you don't have a criminal history check problem with them. That normally can, the registration process can normally stay within the agency. It doesn't have to go out to the Attorney General for a background normally. It's very ministerial, but I think it's important that you know who was in these facilities. So I would certainly recommend that be developed a little further. Along the same lines, I think we need to work toward development of a little more comprehensive approach to what I would refer to as a casino service industry. Definitely the omnibus bill is dealing with technology provider or what we would be called a manufacturer. You were dealing with the first tier of companies that are directly related to gaming revenue. You're capturing, you know, the IGTs, the Bally's, Konami's, Aristocrats, all the big technology providers. But there are other, they're usually considered three tiers. There's the top tier of licensing, which is basically what is in the omnibus as a technology provider. Then there are a mid-tier of service companies that are companies like junket representatives, that are companies like GCA, Global Cash Access, which are companies that do financial transactions for gaming operations. And these companies are normally subject to a mid-level standard of review. And then there are the lowest level of basically registered casino service industry license. For example, White Sand holds a registration in New Jersey where we are registered as a casino service industry. It's the lightest standard because we're not in developing, we're not in the cashier's cage counting money or anything of that nature, but we do work with operators, we do work with sensitive areas and so they want to know who we are. So I think that we should consider in a future proposal, developing not something that's heavy-handed, not something that is terribly expensive, but it is important that you know who the companies are that are working with your licensee. Some states, and this would be one approach, tie a dollar threshold, say, to the mid-range license, and they say you can stay as a just registered at the lowest level until you're making $500,000 a year or more from a casino operator, or a threshold number that would suggest that you're doing enough business with this operator now that we need a little more than just your name and address.
Yeah, well, we had a horse racing business. We did background checks, and even the people who delivered Coca-Cola, we checked everybody. So, and then that's a very good point, because you don't know what you get.
Exactly, you're absolutely right. And back in the day, gaming has come a long way. But in the initial days, in places like Atlantic City and Nevada, it was really places like your laundries and your trash collection, your bakeries. You would wonder why, did you really have to go to New York City for bread, from Atlantic City? So those questions would a lot of times be asked and answered in terms of a background investigation. So very much the same as it racing, I'm sure. So that would be something that I think that the scheme could be augmented. And as I said, it doesn't have to be something where it frustrates the ability of a New Hampshire company to do business with these operations. But you can, again, you do want to know. I don't know if there's any discussion on that, or if there's any
For me, anyway, to see this augmenting of what's in 152 on these technical questions is something that should be done. And, unless something that we say or we see doesn't seem to fit that category, the green light, that's what we're going to do.
Going to page 28, recommendation 12, I think we've talked about this a little bit. Also, the concept of abbreviated licensing, I think we need to just augment what's in 152 omnibus to make it very clear that where you're relying on a license in another jurisdiction, that's just a single component of your background investigation. That's something that is expediting the investigation and the licensing process. It's sort of not in lieu of. You're not going to completely defer to another jurisdiction because there may be developments or connections here in New Hampshire that would be relevant and make reliance on that particular license ill-advised. Same way with the concept that was in actually House Bill 665 and in the omnibus that allowed reliance on a previous investigation. I think especially with the sensitivity of a competitive process for a license, it's very important that you have a level playing field. The racing licensing process is very consistent with what's done in racing. I think you have a 10% qualifier requirement. In gaming, it's normally 5%. So for a variety of reasons, I think that that's a concept that you don't want to move forward with. Again, we've talked about all the reasons behind that. Page 30. This is under recommendation 17. Self-exclusion.
Okay, we have a question.
I know you skipped over, but as far as timelines for these, for at least the competitive licensing process, mm-hmm. Where I think you're going to do the full and the background checks. I think that the bill had like 120 days or so. Is that a realistic timeline to do that?
Well, I think 120 days is very tight. That's a very ambitious timeline, and certainly the recommendation would be that 120-day timeline only apply where there was an ability for an extension of that timeline for good cause shown. There was some language in 152 that was a kind of, in my reading, a higher standard than good cause shown for an extension. And I think it really depends to a certain degree on who the competitors are. The big tier of players have enormous compliance departments. They're under investigation in multiple jurisdictions 12 months of the year. And so if you as a state stick with a personal history disclosure application forms that are you're using the standard multi-jurisdictional forms, and then every state usually has like you would have a New Hampshire supplement if there was something that was particular to New Hampshire. But if you stay within the norms, they should be fairly organized in coming in and presenting. That said, to do a comprehensive review and to allow a real assessment of suitability, it still takes some time. So 120 days is very ambitious. I think 180 days is a more realistic number, that you can do without the good cause and all the gyrations that go with that. I think you see with Massachusetts, it's been more than or close to a year, and they're only acting, on the slots only, and I believe they have probably another 6 months on any of the other licenses.
I think we have to be careful with that. I think that it's, they're only acting on the license application in that period of time. The background investigations on some companies have been done.
Right.
So I'm not sure, how long it's taken them.
It certainly has been substantially longer than 120 days. Yeah.
Well, it's in terms of how many people apply.
Correct.
Right. Too. It's not only who applies, but how many.
And keep in mind, just in terms of reality as well, we were involved at the very beginning of Pennsylvania. Our company worked on the first legal gaming entity in Pennsylvania. And interesting, Maureen was actually on the regulatory side, and we were a vendor. We applied for our license, but you have a new gaming control board learning the ropes, and you literally have not only the applicants, but every vendor, and there's dozens, who want to do business with that applicant. And we applied along with everyone else, but they prioritized. We were not Bally or IGT or Aristocrat, and we were not some of these other entities. We literally got approved for our license and got our license 6 months after we had completed all of our work and had been gone. So there's what's on paper.
Right.
And then they went to a temporary. Well, they said, well, you have a temporary in lieu of our investigation, but it literally took over a year or two
It's really just the competitive process, the gaming license applicants, that their sensitivity. In a standard approach to a casino service industry, to sort of everyone else, you would normally have a basically get an ability or an authorization to do business once a completed application had been filed, and they'll run a quick basic criminal history check. And if the application is complete, you've paid the fees, and nothing comes up in the criminal history check, you're good to go in that status, unless, of course, reserving that something comes up in an investigation that you're basically revoked. But
you don't do that for the license.
No, that is.
Again,
and in this case, you know, you would be doing basically qualification and the competitive process in a tight sequence, not in a phased approach. Again, because of the scale. Again, returning page 30, recommendation 17, at the bottom of that page, dealing with self-exclusion. I would just urge that any type of self-exclusion, definitely you will be doing self-exclusion. In some cases, the way the omnibus was read, basically the individual registered with the licensee to be self-excluded. What I think is the preferable way is that the state handles self-exclusion, and that the person registered with the state to self-exclude themselves, and that the state basically handle the communication of the self-exclusion to their licensee, which includes communication of a picture and other ideas for surveillance purposes. I think if you have a self-exclusion mechanism at the state level, you have the ability with charitable going forward to allow self-exclusion from charitable in the same way that you would allow self-exclusion from a commercial operation. So again, that's something I think keeping it at the state level makes it more multifaceted. Next item to just be thinking about and to talk about a little bit is on page 31, the first bullet. The omnibus consider the standard prohibition on a credit card in a slot machine or a video lottery device, and it further was explicit that credit cards were not a problem for non-gaming related purchases. But that language left sort of a black hole of how to your readiness or receptiveness to the other types of transactions that are routine in a gaming facility. Because again, in today's market, you know, you used to have casino credit. That's really very much gone the way of the world because of the readily ability to cash. But people will want to have debit card transactions or credit card transactions to get access to their own funds for the purpose of gaming. Now, licensees don't normally do those transactions, but they will occur on the property, and you just want to be certain that the language of the statute does not. I would say or recommend that you don't want to frustrate well-regulated money transmitter transactions, because if you do frustrate them, then people will still find a way to get access to cash, and it'll be in ways that are not regulated and not controlled and not provided by licensed individuals. So, you know, years ago I worked with in the Dominican Republic in a casino, and we had I came to understand that we had what was referred to as a presidista. We had a money lender who worked the floor of our operation. And you know, as crazy as that may seem, those type of things still do happen. So I want to make some suggestions about, you know, some language where you're not closing the door to what is normal transaction in a gaming environment. You're not suggesting that people play on credit. But, you know, we all basically use credit cards for everything, and we all usually, you know, try to pay your bill or are responsible. So you're not, it's your money. It's just the way people do business today. And so I just want to be cautious about that language and probably come back with you, to you with a recommendation on a standard conservative, responsible approach to that. And the type of companies I'm talking about, like GCA, I just use them by way of example, they are not located on the casino floor. These are just, you know, in the facility, in the hotel. I'm sure the racetracks have already have these
credit card advantage,
those type of companies. So have them in your racetracks. You're just making sure that you can have those same types of financial services in a gaming operation. 31, again, the bottom bullet dealing with accounting and internal controls. I mean, again, these are nuanced. They're very technical, but they are important policy decisions. Gaming operations will always have a requirement that they have a comprehensive internal control procedures. And these internal control procedures in a gaming environment are voluminous. I mean, your typical accounting and internal control procedures manual would probably be 500 or 600 pages. And it's really, how am I going to pay a jackpot? How many... is a supervisor going to be involved in this transaction? At what dollar threshold do I have two individuals rather than one individual verify the jackpot amount before we pay? So it's very, you know, it's very just procedures manuals for cashiers. States take two different approaches to that. Massachusetts is taking what I would say is more the old-fashioned New Jersey approach, and they are saying as before you implement your system of internal control, we will approve your internal control submission. And that can take months and months and months of review. Spent many years of my career in that process. And so states will choose to have that pre-authorization. Other states, and interestingly, New Jersey is now among the group that has basically a new method, and they say, look, you have your system of control, you submit it, but we will not approve or disapprove it. The obligation to comply depends on you. But for a new jurisdiction, that approach can be bolstered by requiring that that document come into you with a letter, an opinion letter, from a New Hampshire certified public accountant that says, I have reviewed the system of internal controls that the applicant is proposing, and I find that it is sufficient to guarantee the accurate reporting of revenue and that it complies with your regulations, applicable regulations. So someone is looking at the system of internal control. And that's an important process, but you as a state are not obligating your regulating entity to, to initially have that knowledge and to then have to maintain what is basically a department of 3 or 4 people down the road. So what I would recommend is that you do a statute that requires submission but not pre-approval, and that you require as an element of the submission that you get the accountant letter.
Yeah, no, we have the exact same requirement in our gaming vendor agreement, a requirement that an independent certified accountant provide a SOC report, which is a statement of controls report over their system to ensure system integrity, financial controls, and the rest.
Okay, so that would be then?
Yeah, anyway. So we get a report yearly, Barry Dunn, yearly audit of the system,
right.
And then a SOC report produced, you know, some point in July saying, reviewed all their controls, all the systems are in place, and the reporting is accurate.
Do you require that to be by a New Hampshire certified public accountant?
No, but it ends up being one.
Is it like a BMM or a GLI or?
This is called Barry Dunn certified public accountant.
Okay.
The system itself has to be all the RNGs in the system have to be certified by GLI or I think it's just GLI. I don't think BMM we use, but. So that's a different requirement of our system.
Right, but so then that would really be emulating what we're doing on the lottery side, and I think is a more comprehensive approach. I think one of the things you have to, when you're developing a new agency, to be wary of is too much pre-approval, because first of all, you're not going to necessarily have staff with the expertise to do it, and it's just a more costly regulatory approach. And I think you can kind of get that to a different perspective. The next issue I wanted to talk about is at page 32-33, and this is, I know, a sensitive issue on the timeline for rulemaking. I have had the opportunity, really just by luck, to be involved in, as a consultant and as a staffer in a number of new gaming agencies. And I think that New Hampshire has the interim rulemaking vehicle available, and I think that that is something that would be prudent to take advantage of. Not to keep going back to Massachusetts, but I think you're getting a sense studying what they're doing and observing what they're doing, the amount of time and effort that goes into this rulemaking. And I think a very expedited approach would be to, there are really two types of regulations. When you have your enabling statute, it is really going to require you to do rulemaking in two separate areas. You're going to do rulemaking on the licensing side, and that rulemaking is looking at who are the persons that are doing business in New Hampshire. And then you're going to have all the operating regulations, which are how does this person that we've chosen conduct operations in New Hampshire. And what you see is that it's important to get the process right, that you have your licensing, at least an interim licensing regulation in place, and then you can start your application process. And it is very normal and standard for the application and the suitability assessment to run concurrent with the development of all of the operating regulations that you need, so that at a point in time when you're basically through the suitability assessment, the operating regulations, at least on an interim basis, should be in place, and you're really ready to commence operations. So I looked at the language in the omnibus, and I think that it's important that there be a distinction between what is in place when you begin to take an application, what needs to be in place as a prerequisite to that. And I think the important thing is that it is an interim set of licensing regulations, and then you would be working on the operating.
Would you say there has to be a level of regulatory, so that an operator looking at the jurisdiction knows how they're going to do business,
right,
or what it's going to cost?
Right. I think that's the thing. The enabling statute, if it has good definitions and it has good clarification on segregation of responsibilities, all the things that you made a very good attempt at doing in the omnibus and a lot of the things that we've talked about and really have a game plan going forward on, then the regulations are really just an amplification of that. At the end of the day, everyone pretty much, the systems, the slot data systems, IGT makes one, Bally makes a couple of them. At the end of the day, pretty much everyone pays a jackpot the same way. The financial transactions on the floor have become much more standardized because
they're so technology driven. There's not the room for customization that there used to be. Same way with technical standards, with facility issues. So they're a voluminous set of regulations, but if the statute is drafted properly to an educated consumer, to this industry, there will be few surprises in those regulations. What they'll look for, they know they're going to have internal controls. They're just looking, are you going to pre-approve them or take the accountant's letter? And in the statute, you're going to tell them that. The rest of it, they're some states are more stricter than others, but at the end of the day, they know they're going to have accounting and internal control submission. So, again, the rulemaking, to suggest that the rulemaking on the operations side especially is an absolute prerequisite to go forward with an application process is not, from a practical perspective, really a valid assertion. It can and usually does run concurrent. So that's what you're seeing now in Massachusetts. That's what was done in Maryland. That's what was done in Pennsylvania. That's what was done in Ohio. And the interim versus permanent is an important part of the process because, many of you have been involved in rulemaking and you know that it needs to be fine-tuned. And I think, usually after a jurisdiction is up for 6 months or a year, you'll see a massive rewrite because something that sounded good on paper wasn't that great in practice. And you prepared for that. And so that's where I think the interim reg process, it really allows you to do it right and to have in the comment period the dialogue with who your expected industry partners are going to be. And there's a tremendous amount of learning curve on both sides for that process. No. Anyone has any concerns or issues or getting to the end of it, your minds are almost numb. Page 35, number 23. This is something I just want to toss out. This is a policy decision. Child care in a gaming environment is a very sensitive subject. Certainly for employees, absolutely. The concept of child care for patrons is a more difficult topic. One of the things that you need to be aware of is that where you see child care, it's typically a third-party provider. It's not the operator offering the child care. So I just ask you to think about where you'd like to be there. It's a sensitive topic. I know I don't need to tell you that. I just think that the omnibus had that concept in it, and I don't know if that's something necessarily that even needs to be in the statute. That could be just something that develops. And last, if we talked about the payout percentages, the conservatorship provisions that were in the omnibus bill just need to perhaps be revised to take out the concept of a transfer of the license per se. You have pre-approval on a controlling interest, but normally it's a new license. Political contributions, again, a very sound treatment in the omnibus bill of that topic. I would suggest that political contribution that you consider an annual certification. Pennsylvania has a process where they basically require certain stakeholders to make an annual certification that they have complied with the political contribution requirements. And I think that the annual certification is it's kind of a cleansing process for everyone. Because again, you're not going to have the resources to police that otherwise. And the last thing, and again, this is controversial somewhat, but internet gaming is here. I believe Delaware is starting today, and will be the first to offer live internet gaming that is beyond poker. Nevada started with poker. Theirs is a poker-only statute. What's happening is that a lot of jurisdictions are looking at either one of two approaches. They are looking at internet gaming being available through their lotteries as an extension of through their lottery, or they are looking at tying the ability to offer internet gaming to an existing bricks and mortar casino that is fully licensed. So Nevada and New Jersey have tied their internet licenses to a bricks and mortar casino. In Nevada's case, it's not open to every licensee. It's only open to a licensee that has 200 or more hotel rooms. Delaware, in keeping with their state-operated model, has the lottery offering an internet set of games, although it is offered only at their three licensed facilities. So again, I know it's a controversial issue, but with internet gaming and being that you're looking at expansion, you should probably think about addressing it, because New Hampshire, as a small state, is not really going to have the liquidity or the demographics to make a significant amount of money in the internet space, but smaller states or lightly populated states like Nevada are banding together by compact, very similar to the lottery model, and it would just be an additional source of revenue, and it would ensure that New Hampshire has sort of all the sectors, that everything is available.
How important is it to the potential licensee of a casino that they have as an opportunity internet and gaming, and does it have value in the
bidding
process? Again, I think as another amenity, and New Hampshire, and so because everything is intrastate at this point, so even New Jersey with 8 million people, really not big enough pool to spread the risk and to have the cost that would be attractive.
Yeah, if I could, as I chair the government relations practice for the lotteries and have been to D.C. on this very topic repeatedly, and this is an absolute line in the sand for the Senate Majority Leader, Harry Reid from Nevada, who has basically decreed that he won't allow California to do internet gambling for fear of the bricks and mortars in Nevada. And they have been fighting this issue for years in D.C., and have on multiple occasions tried to own the internet space for the benefit of the casinos, and more importantly, to the regulatory benefit of Nevada and New Jersey based on geographic, to the detriment of the remaining jurisdictions in the U.S. And we've had to visit there repeatedly, visit our U.S. senators, visit other U.S. senators, and they've tried to outlaw our ability to sell products and maintain, despite generations and centuries of state-run gambling, they're trying to federalize gambling through the internet.
Yeah, I think there had been a push for a federal approach. I think the general consensus is that the federal approach is dead.
I don't know it to be. I spent a lot of time on that, my ear on that rock. I don't know that to be true. There have been recent suggestions that the Senate Majority Leader, frustrated with his ability to pass federal legislation, is going to, in his mind, fix the Wire Act, the 1961 Wire Act, which allowed this, and banish all internet gambling U.S.-based. It passed a bill. Now, granted, that requires Congress to actually agree on something, but I daily reports on this one, so... And like I said, I was in 2011, December, I was called as an expert to testify in congressional hearing between Frank Fahrenkamp and Mark Liparelli, who's head of the Nevada Gaming Commission, on internet gambling. So really on this one.
So how does this play into our
job? It's really just a matter of if you decided to allow your definition of an authorized game to include the play of a game on the internet. then it would, if you appended that to what would be available to a gaming licensee in New Hampshire, which admittedly would be taking the casino side versus the lottery side, it makes the licensure offering more attractive because it's more full service. It's not a live or die. The companies in New Jersey that are embracing it are embracing it just because things are pretty dire and it's just one other tool in the box.
I guess I'm wondering whether it's such a hot issue that might be one that would be separately considered.
That would be fine. It's just something that we need to know about.
If I could, certainly one of the fixes has been is really we viewed this as a state decision, not our decision, the lottery. State decision, elected officials and the governor as to what they want to do for gambling in their state. What is their tolerance for gambling? And that's long been our approach. So certainly you could frame it in that respect.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's definitely controversial. I agree completely with the director that it's a controversy. It's a fact. It's out there, and you're entering the arena at a time when it's relevant.
I guess I don't know enough about that. Does that internet gaming, is that to that licensee, is that only within that facility? They do it within the facility?
Well, there's two ways to address that. When we're talking about internet gaming, no, it would be intra-state, intra-New Hampshire is what we're talking about. Now, there is the technology, and what's happening now in Nevada and now legal in New Jersey is gaming within the facility itself on a mobile device. And whether it's sports betting or it's playing a slot machine or a blackjack game, that allows them to go within the confines of the facility, whether it's out by the pool or sitting at the bar or sitting at a restaurant, to be able to game. That's two separate things. Yeah.
And if I may just throw, I'm not exactly even sure what requirements are, and I don't know if you run it, but we do not have an income tax. So a internet, I think, would maybe just complicate that, but what are a person from a taxable state comes into New Hampshire, does New Hampshire have a liability, or is that just a responsibility of the person who wins a jackpot?
In
the casino itself. Now, let's say that the guy hits the slot machine and he gets a payout. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Is that a 1099 to him?
It's a W2G. In other words, there are certain IRS thresholds.
Yeah.
And when you hit... it's $1,200 in the gaming environment, casino environment. I think it's $600 on the racing side. Mm-hmm. But the slot machines these days are configured to the point where they will not they will not pay out at that threshold. At $1,200, basically there are functionalities where it prints the ticket and the jack and the W2G form. At the same time, yes, technology has locked that completely down. There are no worries there.
If you take it back to your home state, right, and pay your taxes there on it.
Yeah. But I mean, it's documented and it's reported. So you know, when you file your tax, and that's one of the reasons why the player reward systems are so important that the operators offer, because if you do have a taxable jackpot, you can get a printout of your activity for your tax purposes, mm-hmm, to perhaps show that you lost more than you won.
Well, unfortunately, that's what happens, is you end up losing more than you won, and so there's a net.
So
zero.
Those functionalities are fully developed.
Okay, I didn't recommend
that. I forgot what I was going to ask because you went off on the tax question, but certainly we print 22,000 W2Gs every year.
Right.
I mean,
yeah. All right. Well, my instincts on lottery. Oh.
I just had a comment to interject on the internet gaming aspects and whether we include them or not. While I generally don't make predictions about the House, I think that if you add in that whole other piece you are going to considerably muddy the waters with respect to getting anything through the house, yeah, because I think there will be a perception that somebody's trying to pull a fast one and expand the expansion that has already expanded, you know, not enough for some people, but too much for other people. And I think, much as I think it would be perhaps logical and useful to include it in a proposal as yet another thing that's conditioned on, should the general court determine that this is an area it wants to explore, this is where it comes into our overall scheme, I'm not at all sure that even that isn't going to be more than is reasonable to deal with in this chunk.
Yeah, well, that's good advice. I think that's good advice. All right. You run out of breath and voice and all that.
5 minutes to spare.
What?
5 minutes to spare.
We got 5 minutes. I actually wanted to flag one thing. I guess it goes back to problem gaming. And it's this. It's the question of free drinks. I did some research. I spoke yesterday with White Sands about this. To my surprise, of the 23 states that have commercial gaming casinos, 10 do not allow the serving of free drinks in the casino. And then there are many casinos beyond that in other jurisdictions that at the legal level allow it, that do not allow it. I think as I develop the problem gaming part of this undertaking, that I would include a provision. We can see if we all agree on this later on, or I could get feedback right now, that would alliance with those 10 states on that issue. Discussion. Yes.
Well, I would just say for the benefit of everybody else on the commission that when you and I discussed that in the context of our journey last Monday, when I ran an inn, I wasn't allowed to comp people liquor. I could not do it for less than cost. That seems to me to be a perfectly logical policy position, and I think that given that we already have that for at least some sectors, I think it's
and
one that's
SB 152 embraced the hour limit. The you can't go beyond these hours set by statute in serving liquor inside a casino. The same rule applies. This would simply extend that concept to the serving of free liquor.
Attorney Sullivan. My question on this is, does that cause any competitive disadvantage with respect to customers? If you're given the choice of being New Hampshire or Massachusetts or Connecticut, does that make any difference? I don't know the answer to that. In my experience, it's been it takes so long to get a drink anyway. After you order it, it's almost not even an issue. I want you to be sitting at the machine waiting for the drink.
I would say slight, just very slight. I don't think it's going to be a determinant. But you're also giving them the excuse of why they're not doing it. So they'll say, oh, we'd love to statement, and they'll like that as a cop out.
If I could ask, are there rules you have some major mountain resorts here that are very large operations. I assume that the liquor laws that apply to them would, in the absence of any language in specific, apply to a gaming operation.
Yes, that's right.
And so, it may be just to keep everything, not give them any specific exemption one way or the other. They're just like every other license.
That's right. I think I recollect correctly in the debate on SB 152, there was concern about the absence of language on this issue. And so language was written in to make clear that the curfew requirements apply. All right. So we're making great progress, believe it or not. we will circle back around to existing gaming on next Wednesday, as well as any loose ends, so that the drafting process can go forward thereafter. All right, and that clock is 3 minutes off, so it's now 12 o'clock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
And I remind you, I won't be here.